Hello there. This is VK3OTN, the official call sign of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia, with our regular transmission of news and information for members and friends of the club. This broadcast is presented on the first Monday of each month, except for January.
That was Bill Roper, VK3BR, presenting the opening for the broadcast of December 2010. We will later hear from Bill with another article, and also from Ron Cook, VK3AFW, and Ian, VK3JS. This is Bruce, VK3UV, on behalf of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia. And this bulletin is for June 2020, and is relayed on a number of frequencies, all of which can be found on our website, www.raotc.org.au. And now we come to our club news. And we're pleased to welcome to our membership Robert Moldenhauer, VK2DY, previous call signs VK2KEY, VK1KEY, WH6Y, and N6LTE. And he became full RAOTC member number 1786 on the 8th of May 2020. Welcome to the RAOTC, Robert. Now, here is Bill Roper, VK3BR, who's going to tell us a little bit about the Heath kit that flew. Thank you, Bill.
The Heath kit that flew. This is an item sent in by Clive Wallace, VK6CSW, and it reads, "The Heathcote brand will be familiar to most amateurs, especially old-timers. Many members of the RAOCT may have built one of these excellent electronic kits whose components, instruction manuals, value for money, and backup service set the kit industry standard. Believe it or not, the man behind the company name never made or sold an electronic kit in his life. He made and sold kit set aircraft. Edward Bavard Heath was born in New York State in 1888. His family owned a machine shop where he acquired his engineering skills through practical experience, gaining sufficient knowledge by the age of 21 to successfully build and fly a basic Blériot-type monoplane aircraft in 1909. Barely 6 years after the Wright brothers' first powered flight. A dapper, diminutive man who weighed under 8 stone, about 50 kilograms, Heath was blessed with an inquiring mind, courage, determination, and a great deal of vision. In 1913, now firmly hooked on aviation, he moved to Chicago, where he founded the E.B. Heath Aerial Vehicle Company, a firm built on perseverance, ingenuity, and enthusiasm, but very little capital. Nicknamed Heath's Trading Post, it was a place where pilots could buy parts cheaply. Heath sold wires, fuel tanks, new and rebuilt engines, wheels, turnbuckles, homemade aircraft doped by the barrelful, made wooden propellers, built wings to order, and if he could not find a required part, he would use his engineering skills to make it. Heath built his second aircraft in 1913, a biplane equipped with pontoons, which became a familiar sight over Lake Michigan. Then, as now, flying was an expensive hobby. Heath wanted to change that by building an affordable, easy-to-fly machine. During the World War I years, he developed the Feather, a 20-foot wingspan, lightweight, single-seater, powered by a 7-horsepower modified motorcycle engine, giving a cruising speed of about 45 miles per hour. It was about to be marketed when the American government released a huge amount of World War I war surplus aircraft and engines. The Feather could not compete. Undeterred, Heath established the Heath Airplane Company, selling surplus aviation equipment, and realizing that there was a great opportunity for teaching aircraft purchasers to fly, founded a flying school as part of his company. Although the courses were short, his instruction was thorough, and hundreds of his students not only learned to fly, but also became expert engine and airframe mechanics. A novel Learn While You Earn apprentice scheme became a permanent fixture of Heath's company. Although Heath briefly deviated from his original light aircraft idea by building the four-place award-winning Favourite biplane in 1923 and then the Tomboy Racer in 1925, he returned to his original theme in 1926, building his first Heath Parasol. Now, this was a single-seat, 26-foot wingspan, high-wing monoplane powered by a 27-horsepower Henderson motorcycle engine. A year later, an improved version called the Spokane Super Parasol was introduced. With a cleaner outline, slightly smaller wingspan of 24 feet, and powered by a British 32-horsepower Bristol Cherub aero engine, it was an immediate success. Heath had found his market and used every device to exploit it. You could buy a ready-to-fly parasol for $975, the airframe only for $690, or, if that was still too expensive, buy it in kit form, less the engine, for just $199. To further tempt you, the airframe kit came in 11 groups, the first of which cost a mere $12.47. And if you couldn't find the $12.47, Heath would sell you the blueprints for just $5, and you could find your own materials. The Super Parasol was the foundation of a whole new group of aviators, previously excluded by the high cost of flying. Assembly of the kits required only the use of basic hand tools. Thousands of these little aircraft were built in sheds and barns and garages. One was even built in a church. The aircraft was well designed, sturdy, had clean lines and good flying characteristics. Ed Heath's dream of successfully marketing a low-cost aeroplane had come true. His firm prospered and won an international reputation. These were the first Heath kits, and they didn't contain a single electronic component. Unfortunately, Heath died in 1931, following a crash while testing a new aircraft design, but the company lived on, purchased by Walter Sinan, who relocated the works at Niles, Michigan, a few miles south-southeast from Benton Harbor. 2 years later, the company was renamed the International Aircraft Corporation, but failed in 1934. And another year later, the bankrupt business was bought by Howard Anthony, who changed the name back to the Heath Aircraft Company and relocated it at Benton Harbor, Michigan. The firm traded successfully in aircraft parts up until the end of World War II. During the latter war years, the company began making aircraft radios, and at the end of hostilities, Howard Anthony purchased a large stock of war surplus electronic components, including a substantial quantity of 5BP1, 5-inch diameter electrostatic cathode ray tubes. To dispose of these, Anthony had an oscilloscope design which would sell as a kit set for less than half the price of a comparable factory-built article. The O1 oscilloscope was an instant success and marked the change of the Heath Company from selling aircraft parts to selling electronic kits for both the amateur radio and general electronic consumer market. A characteristic common to all kits was the detailed, unambiguous assembly manual, which, if followed precisely, enabled either non-technical beginners or qualified engineers to build kits guaranteed to work, a feature for which the Heath Company became justifiably famous. By a fateful coincidence, Howard Anthony, like Heath, also died in an aircraft accident. In 1954, while he was conducting a pre-purchase test of a de Havilland Dove twin-engine business aircraft, the flight encountered severe storm turbulence shortly after departing from Benton Harbor's Ross Field. The aircraft suffered structural failure, killing all on board. The following year, Daystrom Incorporated bought the Heath Company. Daystrom embarked on a major expansion, building in 1958 a second factory located in St. Joseph's, just across the river from Benton Harbour. An overseas factory was also established in Gloucester, England, to serve the growing UK and European markets with kits suitably modified for local mains power voltages and frequencies. In 1962, Schrumberger Limited bought Daystrom Incorporated, but continued to trade under the Heathcote brand, further expanding the range of kits available. The 1960s and 1970s were the golden age of Heathcote, with millions of kits being produced. The range was enormous, everything from simple kits designed to introduce children to electronics, to stereo amplifiers, TV sets, complex amateur equipment, test equipment, and even desktop and laptop computer kits. In 1963, the company began to focus on educational and scientific kits, which turned out to be a wise move. Heath claimed that anyone could build their kits provided they followed the detailed instructions to the letter was true. An outstanding feature of many electronic kits was built-in testing.
You're listening to VK3OTN and associated relay stations.
As one part of the kit was completed, it could be used to test and align subsequent sections, thereby guaranteeing that the complete set would work. However, if for some reason it didn't, the company offered a comprehensive problem-solving service. Technical consultants were available via telephone, mail, or walk-in and chat. If necessary, the completed kit could be returned to the Benton Harbour factory for fault diagnosis and repair. Interestingly, the predominant cause of failure was dry soldered joints. In 1979, Schrumberger Limited sold out to the Zenith Radio Company, which, unfortunately for radio amateurs and other electronics kits builders, was more interested in computers and educational kits. By about 1980, component miniaturization, the growing complexity of electronic products coupled with the strength of the US dollar, made Japanese and other Asian imports cheap, making the production and sale of Heath kits increasingly uneconomic. The last amateur radio kits by Heathcote were launched in 1982, but sales were in steep decline. By 1985, the amateur radio division had decayed completely, although computer, educational, scientific, and electronic security kits still sold. In 1989, Zenith Data Systems sold out to the French company Group Bull, a consortium with interest in other companies including General Electric, Honeywell Information Systems, Motorola, and Packard Bell. In 1990, the last PC kits under the Heath Company name were launched. In 1992, all kit production ceased, although product lines in lighting, security, and educational systems continued. Between 1992 and 2007, company ownership changed hands several times, but today, Heathcote Educational Systems remains a viable and profitable enterprise. Well, thanks to Clive, VK6CSW, for a very different Heathcote story.
Last month we gave you the first part of the Titanic, the story of the radio operators on that ill-fated vessel. Here now is part two, with a lead-in of the last 10 seconds of the first article. With the knowledge that the Olympic and Carpathia were steaming towards them at forced draft, he perhaps felt that further talk with the Frankfurt would have been a wasted effort, and it later turned out that he was right. Yeah. Mr. Bride then took the phones and raised the Baltic, while Phillips went out on deck to look around and ascertain just how badly the ship had been damaged. Bride told Phillips, when the latter returned, that the Baltic signal was so weak that he did not think it was worth trying further. So Phillips again took the phones while Bride went into the stateroom and proceeded to get their money together. When he came back to the operating room, he saw a fireman or coal passer trying to relieve Phillips of his lifebelt. The two of them forced him out of the cabin just as the captain came in and told them to look out for themselves, as the vessel was pretty badly damaged and would only stay afloat a few minutes longer. They went on deck together and approached a collapsible boat which several members of the crew were trying to launch on the port side. Mr. Phillips left them, starting aft again, as he wanted to say that the engine room was being flooded, the dynamos were going out, and have a last word with the Carpathia. That was the last time Phillips was seen. The collapsible boat capsized as soon as it hit the water, pinning Bride and several others under it in the icy waters, where they were held for about 40 minutes before another boat finally rescued them. Mention might be made of the fact that only four ships carried two operators at that time, the Titanic, Olympic, Mauritania, and the Lusitania, all the others carrying one operator each, and requiring only that what's necessary for them to handle the traffic of his vessel. It was by the merest luck that the operator Cotham of the SS Carpathia, the vessel that picked up the survivors, heard the Titanic's call for assistance. At 10 p.m, Cotham was receiving press from Cape Cod. The latter station finished with press at 11 p.m. and started with the Titanic on a long string of messages. He then took the press items that he had just copied to the bridge and spent some time there. Returning to his operating room, he decided to get confirmation of a message he had sent to the coast via the SS Parisian earlier in the day, providing that the operator was on watch. He called several times and received no reply, so took off his coat and started to retire. 3 minutes later and he would have missed the Titanic's call and many more lives would have been lost. When Cotham received the CQD call of the Titanic's, he rushed it to the bridge. Returning with the Carpathia's position, Captain Rostron of the Carpathia figured that they were 50 miles from the Titanic, and at a speed of 19.5 knots per hour under forced draft, would cover the distance by 4 a.m. Monday morning. During the last few minutes, the Titanic's radio was in operation. Some nearby steam pipes burst, causing so much interference that it was almost impossible for the operators to work the other ships. This made it necessary for the Carpathia to do considerable relay work. The Carpathia arrived at the scene of the disaster at 4 a.m. and took the first boatload of survivors aboard at 4:10, 20 boatloads in all being picked up, totaling about 720 lives. The Carpathia stood by during the balance on the 15th, cruising around the location where the Titanic went down. But aside from a small amount of wreckage, nothing further was found. About 20 bergs, averaged from 150 to 200 feet in height, were sighted near the Titanic's last position, and extreme care had to be taken by the Carpathia in order to avoid them. The temperature at the time the Titanic struck was 31 degrees above zero, so it is little wonder that there was such an appalling loss from the exposure. According to the final figures set by the officials of the White Star Line, 1,503 people perished, many of them being of world renown. Although no positive proof has ever been submitted, it is believed Phillips died from exposure aboard the collapsible boat. Bride was saved, but suffered severely from exposure and a sprained foot. Cotham, the operator of the Carpathia, remained on duty continuously from Sunday night through to Tuesday night, until he was so completely worn out that he was unable to keep awake. Company messages were handled first, being followed by regular passenger traffic. Very little time was found for reports to the press, as the operators were kept busy with inquiry messages from ashore and reassurance messages from the passengers. So the world did not receive such information of the complete details of the disaster until the Carpathia berthed in New York the following Thursday. The USS Salem and USS Chester were dispatched to the scene of the disaster by the Navy. Severe complaints and criticism were levied against the operator of the Carpathia, as the operator of the naval boats claimed that the Carpathia discriminated and would not work them. It was shown later, however, that the third-class passenger list was sent to the operators on the USS Chester, but it was a long, drawn-out process, as the operator of the naval vessels used the Morse code and the Carpathia operators used the Continental code. This seems to be reason enough for the slight on Cotham's part. The sinking of the Titanic is of special interest to the radio world because it was the primary cause of the standardisation of radio procedure and other measures for safety at sea. From these measures, it might be mentioned the following. Adoption of the Continental Morse code as a standard for all ship operators. Adoption of the conventional cue signals. Establishment of the Ice Patrol Service in the North Atlantic. The requirement for a continuous watch on all passenger vessels. The requirement for auxiliary means of communication and a definite range for the main set. The law regarding telecommunications, regardless of the system, was employed. It was a well-known fact that in the early days a great deal of animosity existed between operators of competitive companies, and the standardisation of SOS as the international distress signal. Many other results could be traced to this terrible disaster. Never in the history of mankind has there been one single event that has caused so thorough a revamping of all laws governing safety at sea. Undoubtedly, thousands of lives have since been safeguarded through this wise legislation. One more item of interest that might be mentioned in closing is that at the time of the Titanic disaster, there were only 4 radio-equipped American ships, each carrying one operator at a salary of $45 per month. These were the SS St. Paul, the SS St. Louis, the SS Philadelphia, and the SS New York. And I now mention that this story came by courtesy of Radio USA of February 1929. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia.
No doubt you all realise that constantly there is new research going on in many, many fields. And here's an interesting little article which I came across in Cosmos magazine earlier this year, written by Nick Kahn, who does editorial work for the magazine and for the Royal Institution of Australia. The article is entitled "The Ultimate in Power Windows." Australian researchers say they've developed new perovskite solar cells that could effectively and efficiently transform seemingly ordinary windows into active power generators. The semi-transparent cells let light through, allowing 2 square meters of glass to be as productive as a standard rooftop panel, yet still be a window, according to a team led by Jacek Jaseniak from the ARC Centre of Excellence in Exeton Science and Monash University. As such, they suggest in a paper in the journal Nano Energy, they could be something of a game changer for architecture and urban planning, as well as electricity generation. Work is now underway investigating how the technology could be built into commercial products, but that is likely to be a decade away. The concept is not new, Jaseniak acknowledges, but he says previous designs have fallen short because they were expensive, unstable, inefficient, or all three. He and colleagues report using a different approach based around an organic semiconductor that can be made into a polymer. When used in place of the common but unstable solar cell component known as SPIRO-OMETAD, it produced astonishing results. Quote, rooftop solar has a conversion efficiency of between 15 and 20%. The semi-transparent cells have a conversion efficiency of 17%, while still transmitting more than 10% of the incoming light, so they are right in the zone. End of quote. The first application is likely to be large windows in high-rise buildings, the researchers suggest. They are already expensive to make, so the additional cost of incorporating the cells would be marginal. Architects could have the flexibility to vary the degree of transparency, and with it, the generation potential. And they may choose to rethink how they position and angle buildings to optimize solar capture. Leading author Jay Chul Yu says the next project will look at a tandem device. Quote, we will use perovskite solar cells as the bottom layer and organic solar cells as the top one, he says.
In keeping with tradition, here is something humorous to help you along. A young law student, having failed his law exam, goes up to his crusty old professor, who is renowned for his razor-sharp legal mind. Student, sir, do you really understand everything about this subject? Professor, actually, I probably do. Otherwise, I wouldn't be a professor, would I? Student, okay, so I'd like to ask you a question. If you can give me the correct answer, I will accept my mark as it is. If you can't give me the correct answer, however, you'll have to give me an A. Professor, All right, so what's the question? Student, what is legal but not logical? Logical but not legal, and neither logical nor legal. The professor racks his famous brain, but just can't crack the answer. Finally, he gives up and changes the student's failing mark into an A as agreed, and the student goes away very pleased. The professor continues to rack his brain over the question all afternoon, but still can't get the answer. So finally, he calls in a group of his brightest students and tells them he has a really, really tough question to answer. What is legal but not logical? Logical but not legal, and neither logical nor legal. To the professor's surprise and embarrassment, all the students immediately raise their hands. All right, says the professor, and asks his favourite student to answer. It's quite easy, sir, says the student. You see, you are 75 years old and married to a 30-year-old woman, which is legal but not logical. Your wife has a 22-year-old lover, which is logical but not legal.
And your wife's lover failed his exam, but you've just given him an A, which is neither legal nor logical.
You're listening to VK3OTN and associated relay stations. Wanted. Material for broadcast and OTN. Yes, we had a couple of items this month, but what about next month? What about next year? We need information on news and events as well as topical short stories. Without your help, we have nothing to present, so please help. We're sure there's a lot going on out there that our members would like to hear about. We need more original articles for OTN magazine. We have quite a few now, but please keep up the supply. Do you need some help getting a part, finding some information, or getting something going? Please let us know so we can give your request a wide dissemination.
Thank you for listening. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia. And we will be back with you again on Monday, the 6th of July. and now we're listing for any check-ins on callbacks for those relay stations that have an operator available. Thank you.